Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-host...
Monthor.
Alright. So, and three, two... All right, I'm not over that. Just a sec.
Control face.
And
I think I broke Dan.
Howdy, y'all, and welcome to episode 160. I'm Monthor, and joining our regular co-host, Makalua.
Who is not caffeinated enough for this.
Dan Q.
Coming at you, post-boo.
Mad Jin.
Apparently caffeinated enough to break Dan.
And the Mian Team.
Sup, son.
Yeah, the sun is up. It's good if you noticed.
Are you going to start singing You Are My Sunshine? Is that,
no.
Is that where we're going with it?
If you would like me to do that, I could do that. I'm capable of singing this song.
Well, if you want some singing.
No,
yeah, absolutely.
Not.
There's always, hey, Makalua.
No.
You know the rule, Mackie. As soon as a guest sings, then it's free reign.
No, it's not.
Oh, yes.
No.
Yes.
No. P.S. The 90s cult.
You still haven't won that sing off. A year, and you still haven't won a sing off.
So, hey, there's a fall patch out. I'm sorry. Typeface makes it look like fail.
It does. It really does.
It does.
It does. It's so, the two L's are so close together, I couldn't tell if that was an I. So, we talked about the patch before, but apparently there was two or three new little additions that have been highlighted in here by Dr. Kane, who took over for 2K Greg. Under the AI, it's added additional sanity tests for deceptive attacks. Previously, if the AI was choosing to deceptively attack, they would not check to determine whether it was a good idea or not, which could result in dumb, quote-unquote, attacks. How do you program the AI to have a sanity check? Are they sane in the first place?
Maybe.
I don't think so.
Calling it that. Basically, it was just allowing them to bypass a certain important part of code if they decided to do one kind of attack versus another.
Yeah. Enemy has 1,500 units on my border. I know. I'll send three over there to get them.
It's certainly a surprise attack.
Yeah, that would be expected.
Surprises in. What were you thinking?
I mean, what it realistically means, though, is they decide to go attack something and then get there and then find out they've already moved all your units over there. So would preferably not attack anymore. But then they'd still have a bunch of units hanging out outside of your borders for a couple turns getting ready for it.
Yes.
But moving on.
Yeah, that was the only new thing to AI. Under units, make sure the caravels and destroyers always have the withdraw before melee promotion, if you don't own DLCO2, which I guess, is that Gods and Kings?
No, that's Inca Spain. So the Incan Slinger has the withdrawal before melee promotion. At least it was the only one before Gods and Kings. And then both caravels and destroyers gained it, but apparently somebody forgot to move the promotion over.
Dope. And also, barbarians should now spawn in their cap if it is empty of combat units instead of beside it. Aw, you mean I can't just run in and destroy their camp right after they spawn anymore?
Yeah.
Darn.
Plus, they get to move after spawning in single player again.
What? Why would they do that? That's stupid.
I don't know. Multiplayer barbs have always moved as soon as they spawned. So now single player people get to play with that.
Why do you let them telefrag? That's so annoying.
Go, telefrag.
Maybe some of our listening base is too young to understand the terminology, since it's not typically seen in games anymore. But, you know, old-school games like Doom had teleporters, and if you chased somebody into a teleporter and teleported on top of them, you'd kill them instantly. That's what I'm getting that from. And barbs that can move after spawning do this, because they appear and then move, so essentially they're moving three tiles from the camp and telefragging you. It's a good way to lose workers, especially if the camp only spawned recently.
Mm-hmm.
That was everything under bug fixes, under balance changes. One thing for the AI, If it was able to build the UN but would not win based on the current vote breakdown, the AI will refrain from constructing it unless conditions change.
Yay!
I'm just going to go over here and build the UN just because I can. Derp.
You do get an extra vote, right? Is there a reason to delay it?
It starts the countdown. And if the AI, I mean, really what it's coming down to is the AI usually builds the UN as it's going for a science victory, even though the UN's not on the science path. They could be, you know, one tech away from their last part and somehow decide to build the UN while they're trying to build that last part. And it's not a good backup.
Yeah, that makes sense then.
Especially when building the last part takes less time than building or waiting for the vote for the UN. So the other side to it is you don't want somebody, you know, if one AI has 90% of the city states, you don't want a second AI randomly building the UN just because. Because there's a good chance that the one with most of the city states is going to fight and keep them.
Then suddenly,
that's true.
I win.
But that's a different reason than just, you know, we're not going to win. That's if we build this, the other guys win.
Yeah.
Which I'm glad that they finally did something about that in Civ 5 because they certainly didn't do anything about it in Civ 3 or 4.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you can still use great engineers to rush the UN. That change would be nice. Make it a project.
Ah, yes.
Two engineers equals insta-UN, which is bad.
Yeah, I don't think it's ever been considered a project in any of the Civ games.
Yeah, but prior Civ games, it wasn't build it and win.
Well,
it was build it in attempts to win.
Well, it's not an auto-win in Civ 5 either. You have to still get the votes. But if you had the votes in Civ 4, it might as well have been a build and win then, too. There are only a couple turns before its completion and the victory vote.
I mean, because you can have declaration of friendships with multiple civs, but if they like somebody else more than you, even though you're friends, that doesn't mean that they're going to vote for you. So you actually do have to get the most friendly rather than just friendly.
Yeah, it's a much better system. Diplomacy has never been that well thought out, but we're getting closer.
Yeah, you can still buy up all the city-states.
Yeah,
money still buys an election.
That's good,
wait, what?
Though, because that allows you to economic advantages for leverage as well. You know, like if you're so strong economically that you can buy out everybody and you can't prevent that, then it's kind of like cornering the world energy market in Alpha Centauri. You know, you just have that much money. And especially considering that Civs probably should, and they certainly can, each try to win away the control of one city-state. You know, if you can still get enough city-states, that's pretty ridiculous. You kind of deserve to threaten to win that way.
Just not the last minute declare war on everybody as you take all their stuff and then use that on city-states. That's not quite the same.
Oh, I mean, come on.
Of course, if Austria is in the game, she'll just buy all the city-states and take them over.
Yep. And then you have to play nice with your other AIs to win.
Yeah, that's true.
So absolute Austria balance. Being in the game is a good thing for balance.
Subjected.
Well, maybe on that victory condition, but that's it.
But under polish, under general, they added a combat weapon parameter that allows for a projectile that is not going to do any damage to have a miss radius. This helps spread out projectiles and there are a lot of attackers, but only one or two targets. I guess that means if you're facing a unit that's only got like two figures left and you have a full unit, some of them will miss and go behind them instead of all of them magically being like magnetically attracted to the two guys left.
Pretty much.
Just an animation thing?
Yep. Purely an animation thing.
Yeah, that's what the polish section. Whatever. It's the polish section, not the polis section.
Yeah. Actually, modders apparently like that because as they add different types of units, they might do different styles and stuff. So, you know, if it doesn't make sense that you have 10 units and they all hit that one guy, then it would look really weird.
I can see that. Makes sense.
And we've added one whole new section that is Win 8 in Ultrabook, which is what we saw in one preview, I believe, was that we saw a video where they were using their fingers to do all the things on the touch screen with Civ 5. So that's what was in the patch. Part of we're going to get that.
Yes, now you too can give the finger to Win.
You too could.
Or you could two and three finger it too. I mean,
you look at the video. You maul hand.
You could also use your whole fist. Now, the patch was about 20 megabytes in size, and there have been some technical concerns. If you are experiencing difficulties, there is a DirectX diagnostic tool called DXDIAG. So if you go to your start and then you've got a text field and you type in DXDIAG, you'll be able to run that tool. And in addition, if you go to your Civ5 root directory and look for any files with the extension MDMP, if you include the DXDIAG report as well as attach those files, the MDMP files, along with your save files, it will help Civ developer Firaxis and publisher 2K Games narrow down your difficulty. For some people, and it's actually noted with the Windows 8 and Ultrabook update, you want to update your Intel driver if you are running Intel HD graphics. Apparently there was an update in October 2012, and I must admit I rolled my eyes a little bit at that. When it comes to a number of updates to your system, particularly when it comes to graphic drivers, I kind of like to go with the expression, if it ain't broken, don't fix it. But in any event, if you are experiencing crashes, because some people are reporting almost immediate crashes or within 20 or 25 turns on save games, on new games, then that may be something that you have to look at. This patch is only for PC. It is not yet for Mac. That will have to come from the Mac.
Mackie?
Oh, there are lots of things that can come from Mackie, but a Mac port of Civilization V Gods and Kings, and the patch for this is not one of them. The change version is 1.0.2.13, so if you are wondering if the patch has been successfully downloaded, there's that. But you also want to check the integrity of your game cache, and that's documented. That's a Steam option to see if perhaps one or more files were not downloaded completely or there was something corrupt about it when it was trying to extract and update. That has worked for me in the past. I think I had that issue with the last patch, and I ran that. It took, I don't know, a minute or so, and it fixed it. I had to re-download a couple of files. It wasn't any major deal. But the two bug fixes, the balance change and the polish change, it was interesting to note, and I'm probably reading too much into this, but that's okay, because it gives me a chance to talk more. Under the bug fixes, both the AI and unit item is listed last. Under balance changes, that balance change is listed first. And under polish, that item is listed the fourth of six items. So I wonder if that's kind of a subtle inference in terms of how important 2K and Firaxis think these changes are. And so the fact that the AI balance change, with we're coming to whether or not they build the United Nation, that being listed as a first item, I think that's fair. One thing I would have liked to have seen, though, is under bug fixes and units where it talks about withdraw before melee promotion, even if you don't own DLC-02, it would have been helpful to actually just explain what DLC that was. I mean, DLC-02...
Yeah, that's why I had to ask. I was like, okay.
Yeah, but don't you count them as they go? DLC 1, DLC 2, DLC 3.
Look out, Majin. There's a bunch of unit DLCs. 17s on your border, and there's like 5 or 6 unit 19s as well.
I know. It's awesome. Actually, one thing to state with what Dan already said, at least from trolling the forums, I'm noticing a lot of people have quoted different file sizes for the patch. I've seen a number of different file sizes, so that tells me that this patch, more than previous patches, because we didn't have that much variance before, but this patch, more than previous ones, you want to verify your cache before coming to complain, because there is a higher likelihood if you had less than all of the files that something will break. So definitely good, re-verify after you download.
I wonder if that has to do whether you have gods or kings, gods and kings or not. Because when I downloaded it yesterday, I think it was only 15 something. Because I don't have that yet, so that may be part of the difference, depending on what DLCs you do and don't have installed.
Plausibly, though, DX9 people apparently do have a bug where it's painful to play, but that's what you get for playing on DX9. So. and that's the general commentary. Either it's bugged or like there's crash issues with the X9 at the worst side of it, or it's the most awesome patch ever, because for some people they're the turn times have increased decreased by 75%. So some people are seeing real big improvement in the AI turns. They could have older machines, and some of the optimizations could have been compounded for them to make it even better.
To those in our audience who speak Leet and didn't quite understand what Majin was saying, that's the best patch ever. Patch ever.
Ever.
You didn't quite say it correctly, so I translated for you.
It's either really awesome or can't play it.
Or it's really awesome after you figure out how to play it again. Civilization Online massively multiplayer online game for Asia announced. Now, I don't remember what episode it was discussed, but actually XL Games made an announcement about this, I think either earlier this year or late last year that they were doing that, and no one really paid it any never mind, because where's Take-Two's comment on that? Nothing, 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 and then, oh, here's a press release from Take-Two.
Are you surprised?
No, not really. I think the best comment I've read, which was from a Polten Civilization site where Andamang said, "Finally, I can move to South Korea and become a professional Civ player."
Might not catch on.
Is this going to be the next game featured on MLG? GB2, no Montezuma Rush.
Yeah.
So this XL Games is a studio behind the massively multiplayer online role-playing game Lineage, which has over 43 million players. Now, neither Take-Two or XL Games revealed any specifics about Civilization Online, but the person who is leading this, Jake Song, he's the chief executive officer at XL Games, says that there is a team of more than 100 employees developing Civilization Online, which reportedly makes it one of the biggest game productions in South Korea, according to VentureBeat. So Civilization Online will be joining NBA 2K Online, NBA 2K All-Stars, and Pro Baseball and 2K Games' Asian continent strategy. Free to play is a staple of this lineup, and that trend will likely continue with this version of Civ, speculates VentureBeat. VentureBeat also dares mention another online Civ game. Firaxis' founder Sid Meier previously designed Civilization World for Facebook, but that game did not turn out so well. It debuted in May 2011, but the crowds didn't come.
Yeah, and then some.
I played it a little bit and then blocked it.
You blocked it.
Denied.
We are not friends. The Wall Street Journal had a rather extensive article on this. They quoted Take-Two's chief executive officer, Strauss Zelnick, where he said, "Choosing to focus on building a Civilization game for South Korea because strategy-type games are popular there."
Does this guy not even read his own comments from before when he randomly makes other comments?
Strategy-type games probably, yeah, they're... Things from Blizzard are popular there, guy.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say.
Strauss, let me quote for him specifically. "Civilization, there's real untapped demand for it there."
Really?
Something to play on their off days in between practicing for their Star Leagues.
Maybe it was untapped for a reason.
At the risk of continuing potential innuendo further, said the chief operating officer for Take-Two's 2K Games Unit Division, David Ismailer, "We haven't really penetrated Asia."
Oh, dear, that's unfortunate phrasing.
Yeah.
Apparently, many of Take-Two's staff hired overseas are also being brought to the United States for training to ensure they can produce the same quality of work from the remote studios, which is a contrast if you're thinking about Civ World still, perhaps.
Wait, 2K?
Yes, they're, yes, 2K.
Who are they training? What?
Yeah, because they don't build stuff, at least not the Civ-type things.
Further, Zelnick said, "We're expanding our relationship with consumers by meeting them wherever they are, whatever device they want to use, with whatever experience they want to have, whatever business model they want to use, wherever they're located."
As long as it's a first-person shooter on a console.
Yeah, pretty much.
For his efforts, Jake Song, I mentioned before, the chief executive of XL Games, says, "It isn't easy, but we have some great ideas that will keep its essence and also introduce a new online experience that will be shared by thousands of others, in theory."
Yeah, I hate when people say it'll keep its essence, because the essence in when they usually say that is, it'll keep the name, but that's about it.
Yep.
I'm just waiting for them to talk about synergy, and
they will synergize their penetration?
While working within the context of the paradigm shift of online gaming.
Yes.
Oh, there's that word. Crap.
Yeah, there you go.
Just wait. They'll add more K-pop into this game.
That would actually be fun.
They probably will. They'll have to, actually, if they're going to Korea.
Yeah. Contractually mandated, there will be more K-pop.
It's going to be one of their more sound business decisions in this entire thing by the looks.
It'll be the only smart thing.
Unfortunate.
Or K-pop.
There were quite a few number of news articles. I've just found bits and pieces from, thank you, Google News. David Ismailer also said that Civilization Online is an example of how 2K can leverage its successful franchises beyond sports to create entirely new experiences in genres that resonate with customers in this region.
Wait, they had a successful sports franchise?
Zing.
Now. They must be referring to that NBA 2K Online and the NBA 2K All-Stars and Pro Baseball that they already have as free-to-play. It must be what he's talking about. I don't know.
Yeah, it's really successful when you don't have to pay to play it.
Game Trailers' Dan Seitz was excited about this. It's a compelling idea, but we're not sure how Civilization detailed gameplay will scare to millions of players. But that Firaxis is pitching in is a good sign that the strategy fans know and love is still going to be part of the game. That's very optimistic.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's not going to happen, but I don't know why Complex's Human Welch says, hopefully the devotees of Sid Meier won't toss themselves into the abyss lemming style on receiving this news.
What?
No, because they're all over here in North America. They don't get to play it because this is going to be an Asian game.
And they would not comment, by the way, on the possibility of it reaching Western shores.
In other words, we're totally planning for it, but we're going to surprise you with it.
Later, after it fails in Asia.
Mm-hmm. They're going to run it for 2 years and cancel it in Asia and bring it over here to try and recoup their money. Yep.
Finally, in terms of comments that I found, PlayTM's Ewan Iten says that this is the final frontier for the Civilization series to explore after hitting consoles and mobiles with Civilization Revolution and going social with Civilization World on Facebook. The final frontier? Really?
You're invoking an entirely different thing there, guys.
Yeah.
Entirely different fan base.
Perhaps maybe the final word on this can go to one of our users in the Ustream chat, Amventus. Is it even possible to turn turn-based into an MMO? Well, they're certainly going to try.
Yep.
I don't get it. The time between turns is going to take too long.
Yeah.
Don't have a good enough interface. How are you supposed to use a 300 ATM in a game like this?
Because, I mean, that's their problem. I don't think they understand their market quite as well as what they think. A strategy game, a more real strategy game, does not play well in an area where real time is the important thing. And not only is real time the important thing there, it has to be a sport type thing to really play well, i.e. something about StarCraft
thing.
Being an online sport, and it's becoming real. Real money is going into that sort of thing. So while 2K might want to slowly follow that to try and tap that market, problem is they're probably using the wrong game. Because just because StarCraft has the S of strategy, the end of the RTS, that doesn't mean it's a strategy game. There is strategy.
It is, but it's different.
It's not it's different even from remotely turn-based. The same.
But it stops there. That's where the similarity stops.
Yeah, there's an S in both of them.
I actually kind of see them most likely going the way they did with Warcraft, changing it from a strategy game to an RPG, which just annoyed me.
How can you RPG through the ages and still call it building a civilization?
I don't know, Imagine. Apparently, XL Games and Take-Two are going to tell us how.
No, they won't. No, I have a feeling it's probably going to be like Civ World on crack. Although with XL Games being the one doing the most of the work, at least connectivity will work, don't they?
I'm sorry, is it like Civ World only on crack? So this is going to make it better or worse? What?
Yeah, probably.
Who's trying to follow?
Basically, what I have a feeling that they're going to go with it is that you'll still be building civilizations, you'll still go through the game over time, but you'll be able to hire people to manage various things and have mini games along that line. but it won't work that way.
Speaking of trying to ruin your day, going for a cultural victory?
No, I'm not.
You're not trying to ruin our day, or you're not trying to go for a cultural victory?
Both. Actually, technically I am. People are waiting for it. So, cultural victories. Condition the hardest to achieve. This thread was started by Greedy's Maximus, and it is an extremely long thread. Got many, many, many pages. Which somewhat points to maybe it is, or at least it has a lot of discussion. So his question is, I'm asking this because I have a lot of problems with the optimization of my cities, buildings, priorities, and some more generic issues. I play almost exclusively on King. Barbs are a nuisance, but that just means go get some units. So other than that, more important question is the AI. If my forces are negligible, will this fact incite my neighbors to be more aggressive? Generally. So this is actually my biggest problem in all my games. So you started with this. So, and eventually it gets to some good questions. So maybe I should neglect the Wonders buildings early on and just take a neighbor out for security reasons and resources. Sometimes that is useful. Depends on how close they are. If they're going to be in your way, or they have really nice stuff, then yes, it can be nice in a culture game. Unless you're trying to play peacefully, that is. Which wonders should I prioritize? Is Porcelain Tower a must? What should I start building my first wonder, or when? RAs are a waste of gold or needed, since you also need the cultural city-states to start pumping you that culture. And what policies do people usually use for culture win before they go into piety? So that's really the core questions for this thread. And it goes on and on and on. There's arguments about whether piety is good or not, and then people with knowledge pop in and say, stop complaining about piety, because you need it for a culture game. What it boils down to is, if you're trying to remain peaceful and not do mass puppet style for a culture game, then yes, it's harder than the other victory conditions, mostly because of the whole trying to stay peaceful and trying to build culture rather than build, say, an army or build science. Because you don't get to horribly abuse great scientists to rip through the tech tree. Unlike with diplomacy, you can do it. With science, obviously, you're planning on doing it. And even with domination, you can just focus on just straight scientists for your specialist and get to higher level techs easily. Whereas with culture, your actual focus is getting landmarks. So you're going to fall behind tech-wise. And once you hit the Renaissance, it's not so bad. The game continues on as per it would be in vanilla. But that first 100 turns getting up and running and getting to the Renaissance tends to be harder in a culture game, because you can't just toss cities down anywhere, and you can only have a couple of them. And on top of that, well, you don't really want to be at war in the first 100 turns if you can help it. I mean, if you have a close neighbor and you go to comps of bows, you can deal with it. But you really want to focus on the culture side of things relatively early, at least for the wonders and the general stuff. So, yeah, getting attacked early can really throw you off your game. That doesn't mean it's not possible. There are plenty of people that are getting culture wins. It's just slower than the other two non-domination wins and can be more painful depending on what your map looks like.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. Is it more difficult the right way of phrasing it, or is it just slower? Because you have things like space. You know, they were definitely not as difficult as conquering everybody, but they tend to be slower than a pure conquest. And I don't know. I don't know if it's the hardest to achieve or if it's the slowest to achieve. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, to that end, M. Ventus said in the chat, in my opinion, cultural victory condition is one of the easiest, at least for me, at Emperor level.
Yeah, but it depends on your map and all that sort of thing, and your difficulty level, too.
It's always true to some extent with all the victory conditions. I just don't think that on an average basis, culture is actually a harder victory condition to win than other victory conditions, as opposed to simply being slower.
The harder part is you're not expanding very much. So that's the thing. With all the other victory conditions, one, you don't have to plan for it right away. And if you fail a culture early game, then you can just turn into one of the other three, whereas you can't do the opposite. So that does make some people think it's a little bit more difficult. But also, if you have a really bad starting capital area, for the other three victory conditions, well, just go take somebody else's land and continue on. you can keep expanding and expanding. A culture game, if you have a bad starting area, then you're not playing a culture game at that point. You just can't. Really bad map can basically throw it out. I've seen some bad starts that I would just not even consider for a culture game because there's not enough food or there's too much jungle or there's no, well, having a river is useful for a culture victory, but you don't, if you don't have the food, the production mix to get really tall and high production, then it's really hard to start a culture game. If you're trying to play any of the other ones, well, you just spam out settlers or spam out military and go take it. And you can do that for a culture victory for the go take it, but then it depends on your style of culture that you're going for. If you're going OCC, then you can't do that. If you're going mass puppet, then sure, but it's basically a conquest game that you eventually fell into a culture game. but if you're just going for the 3-4 city max self-planted peaceful type, then you can't really do it. And that's where things start hitting it, because you don't have the time to build all the units while you're building all the buildings and trying to get wonders in. So it can be considered a bit more painful if you have aggressive AIs as neighbors rather than having peaceful ones. Other than that, I mean, if you survive the first 50 to 75 turns without taking any real damage from the AIs, it plays fairly similar to vanilla, and you should be able to win it, provided you get to key wonders in time.
Mventa says in the chat, under 300 turns was possible for a cultural victory condition. One of my cultural games was with India, where I took over some Mongolian and Greek cities because they had declared war on me. Puppets were good for gold and free culture.
Yep, puppets are good. Part one of the other things, too, is choice of social policies, when you choose them, how you choose them. You don't have quite the same push as you do in the culture side of things, where you must go in to get the cost reduction penalties, depending what when you're doing it or whatever. So you need to get into piety, you need to go finish freedom, and then you need to, you know, this, that, and the other. And without those extra scientists or engineers, it slows you down a little.
And perhaps as maybe a final front when it comes to the cultural victory condition, you mentioned piety, which of course makes me think of religion and the religion mechanic that Gods and Kings introduced. What is a best or a better approach in terms of going about to founding a religion, spreading a religion, choosing your various beliefs?
Yes, get a religion. It helps. It's actually, it's faster. And if it's faster, then you're more likely to get it before one of the AIs gets something else. Stonehenge start, you can skip all the shrines because a wide empire can produce more faith than a small empire. Even if you're tall, you're still not going to produce extra faith. But now you have the Grand Temple, the shiny, shiny Grand Temple, to help jam in a bunch of extra faith. But you can only build that in your holy city, so you can't count on it to found a religion. You have to have founded the religion before you can build the Grand Temple, which is kind of weird. It's the only national wonder like that. Otherwise, take pantheon beliefs that give you more faith if you have that type of terrain around. That's one of the best ways, especially when you're going to stay with 1-4 cities. Ally up religious city-states early and then switch to culture later. Basically, find faith where you can. Get up to at least 10 faith per turn. And then you should be able to found a religion, provided no one else is doing silly things. Like in one of my games recently, somebody founded a pantheon on turn 2 on standard speed. Even on turn 2, even the Celts can't found pantheon on turn 2, even if they're surrounded by forests. They tripped across a rune, which gave them all the faith they needed for the pantheon. And I think they took the desert faith bonus. So it just got dumber and dumber. As for if you found a religion, cathedrals, and more cathedrals. A lot of people say get cathedrals or restart. I find that weird, but they are pretty powerful because they give you an extra artist slot, which means you can add extra culture and get artists faster, and they produce 3 culture per turn themselves, along with a little bit more faith and a little bit more happiness. So cathedrals are the religious follower belief when it comes to the culture game. Otherwise, most of the other stuff is irrelevant. Founder belief, you can either go money or you can go happiness. Now that peace-loving is fixed, where it doesn't interfere with your other happiness stuff, as long as you can stay peaceful, you can get a crazy amount of happiness if you can get your religion into everywhere. And that happiness gets converted to culture, so it makes it even better. Plus, you can get Golden Ages faster, so it's pretty good.
Plus, if you've got the Korean DLC with the cathedrals, that extra artist slot is also more science, so you can get to those key wonders faster.
True.
Perhaps speaking of relevancies and irrelevancies, another victory condition that we often do not talk about on this show.
Somebody asked, how can I achieve faster victory conditions? And they provided their save file from an Immortal Pangaea science victory with Babylon that they completed on turn 286, it looks like. Well, with Babylon, I mean, yeah, get scientists out a lot faster, but I still think Korea is a better science civ.
It depends on what you're doing.
Yes, that thread was started by Civ Decimation in August of this year, and then there was a general inquiry from Grom358 in another thread, which was, what are some of the key points to achieving a science victory quickly?
Yeah, it's all about speed here.
Well, some of the key points, of course, you want to get more scientists out so you can put down a couple of academies, at least in the earlier game. Sign research agreements. Definitely need those if you want to speed up your game. It's having to play nice and declaration of friendships. At least with Gods and Kings, you have to have declaration of friendship in order to sign a research agreement.
Yes, actually, I think this patch is going to deal with their sub-240 victory conditions for science. And it'll actually be looking back and going, hey, you know what? Turn 286 victory? That might have been a good time.
And of course, with science victories, you got a big difference between vanilla and Gods and Kings, because in vanilla, whenever you bulb with a scientist, you get to pick a free tech. In Gods and Kings, it's based on your beakers per turn, and it just gives you beakers for the last 6 or 8 turns?
8 turns.
If for 8 turns you had 200 beakers a turn, you would get 1,600 beakers towards whatever tech you're researching. Golden Ages are for boosting culture. Kind of why you want to have a few academies early with your first great scientist, or 2 or 3 or 4, depending on your game and how you're playing it.
After by the time you're building public schools.
Yeah. Well,
once you're done building a bunch of science buildings, or you just conquered a whole bunch of people.
Yeah, one rule of thumb is whatever turn you're on, you want to have your beakers per turn at least double that.
Well, I mean, for the when to your bulb, for those 8 turns, it's usually 8 turns after you finish research labs in all your cities and have them all filled up.
Right, so that you're maxing out your beakers per turn. And that's one of the reasons why I like Korea over Babylon, because you can get much higher beakers per turn, so those bulbs are a lot stronger.
Yeah, or Babylon just settles more great scientists first. Works both ways, buddy. It all depends on the map and how things work. But basically, the time to wait is once you're basically done increasing your beakers per turn in major ways. So, I mean, obviously, if you're just adding a couple more population or whatever, that's not really worth waiting for. But and remember to keep all your specialists in your buildings. Unlike in vanilla, where you can, after you're finished building all of your great scientists, you can just pop your specialists out and start working on production. You can't do that in Gods and Kings. You have to leave them there. Otherwise, your beakers per turn will drop.
Exactly. But like I was saying, with Korea, yes, Babylon can have more academies going. But for every 4 academies Korea has, that's like a 5th academy because of the extra 2 they get for each one.
Yeah, but then we're back to Babylon just having 50% more academies. So you need more than 1 extra every 4 to catch up to that.
Well, when you also add in their specialists that they're going to be running to get those scientists, each one of those is an extra 2, and it's not just the scientist specialists, it's all specialists.
Well, yeah, but you're not going to run other specialists because you don't want those other people.
You're going for a science victory or not, at least.
Yeah. Anyways, not that we're randomly fighting over Babylon versus Korea. More generally, there are other civs that can play a science victory.
In the chat, Mventa says, "Hi Pop City Help. I was able to win a one city challenge science with Patrick Cootie. His UI is great, and you start near the mountain so you can get the observatory with those terraces. I was able to get a Pop 40 city, and for the game 90% of the time, I was first in demographics in that area, and I believe that win was under 200 turns.
Yeah, for me, it's the under 200 turns or close to 200 turns on standard speed. I'll qualify that. Standard speed, if you were getting Gods and Kings science victories under turn 250 beforehand, because RA, or research agreement abuse, was massive because of the research agreement bug that was giving more and more beakers and getting upwards like 25K worth of beakers before it rolled over and people got 0 because they overflowed too much.
Nice.
So I'm expecting the super fast times to get slowed down a lot because of that. Research agreements got fixed, so they can't get too much extra science. Plus, with the patch, the diplomatic side of things got stretched out a little bit. So some AIs might take longer to decide to hate you and declare war because of the diplomatic goalposts. But on the other side of that, some AIs may not be as friendly to you right away as they used to because that goalpost got moved as well.
Well, that's the other key point that MVentus is bringing up here is population equals science. You yep. want to grow your cities if you want to have good science.
Oh, yeah. Hyper tall is very good for science victory. Actually, I don't think I've seen anybody really go wide or at least espouse like super wide for fast science victory. I think the most people have said, especially in this thread, is 6 cities at the most for going very, very fast on the science side. Well, the last little trick, of course, after you save that for the 8 turns worth of bulbing, to save your Oxford for rocketry, have it pre-built, have an engineer faith bot from order, and then as soon as you're ready to go, you can use Oxford to open up the Hubble Space Telescope, and then use the engineer to finish the Hubble Space Telescope, and get 2 more great scientists to bulb the rest of the way out.
Yeah, along with that, you also want to try and save your rationalism finisher to get those 2 free techs towards the last 2 parts, you know.
Yeah, or at least on the way to them. I found that if you wait for the rationalism finisher and you're holding on to great scientists, you can go past it by quite a distance if you generate too many great scientists to the point where the last 2 techs from rationalism gives you like giant death robots because you have nothing better to spend it on anymore.
We're going to look at Civilization 4 here. Civ Illustrated number 1, Know Your Enemy. This thread rather was started by Kate Zilla, who is part of the editorial team on this Civ Illustrated effort. This issue is called Know Your Enemy, quoting the famous Sun Tzu. It covers the different civilizations when they are played by the AI, specifically in Civilization 4 Beyond the Sword. It aims to be a tool most useful to veteran players who want to make that jump to Emperor or Immortal or Deity. It is also intended as a all-in-one reference for each AI so that they can be linked in with other forum threads as a resource. And I think that that is probably the greatest strength of this resource is, first and foremost, compiling information that's already out there, but then trying to link that information together so it's not just a bunch of data. It's not just knowledge, but there's an understanding of how they relate to one another. I do like his point in his post where he says, don't read this guide if you enjoy the mysterious AI surprising you. So the information that's included here, and he goes into some considerable descriptions, and I'm going to summarize kind of each in part in a way. 16 items on this list. Name and picture. Practically required so viewers know which AI is being described at a glance. Yes, that's a good way to start. The starting technologies. If an AI starts with hunting, they will have a scout instead of a warrior. Or if they start with mysticism, expect them to found an early religion. Civ traits, the unique advantages that an AI will have throughout the game, the unique unit and building, pointing out the differences between these units and the buildings as compared to their regular counterparts, favorite civics. We fear you are becoming too advanced. This information should be considered mostly accurate, and it describes how there are 3 ways to continue trading with an AI once they begin telling you this. The first is for both the AI and yourself to be in the bottom half of the scoreboard. Second way is to reach friendly with the target civ, and the third way is to take the target civ as a vassal and then tell them, why don't you research X and then research something else and trade it with them once they finish.
It does depend on difficulty as well. So he lists them for Emperor and then tells you, you know, that it changes whether you go higher or lower in difficulty. But a given AI is still going to be more or less stingy, depending on difficulty. But they're still also going to be more or less stingy compared against other AI.
Number 7, will trade technologies that some percentage of other AI knows, describing the message, we don't want to start trading this right now. It should be considered a rule of thumb and not accurate information. Perhaps someday someone will unravel the mystery in totality. Number 8, the 8 0 to 10 rankings that rank the various civs using a relative scale based on whole numbers. Build wonders, relatively straightforward, so is build units. Espionage spending is how many resources a civ tends to spend on building spies, espionage buildings, and the use of the espionage slider. Resist capitulating is a bit more complicated, describing how much more powerful the player must be than the AI before it will capitulate. The number of turns before an AI will talk peace should probably have also been included, but it was deemed to not be as important and avoided another complicated composite rating. The other factor in capitulation besides power is war success. You need a war success score of 40 or more before a civ will capitulate, along with the required power ratio. Ask for help is when a civ is pleased or friendly with you and asks for technology, gold, or a resource. Make demands is when a civ is cautious, or annoyed, or furious with you and demands that you give them a tech, gold, or a resource. Demand you convert is when an AI spreads their religion to one or more of your cities and demands you switch to their religion. And demand a civic change is, well, when an AI demands that you change your civic to match theirs. Number 9, declare war of conquest on neighbors with whom they are annoyed is an overall measure of how often a civ goes to war. There are three kinds of war that the AI engages in Civ 4. There is total war, limited war, and dogpile. JI has a separate rating and desire for each of these types of war, but rather than have three separate war ratings for each Civ, it was decided by members of Civ Illustrated that the average user would not be able to tell the difference between what type of war an AI was waging, so the most important type of war was selected, and that's when the AI wants to conquer you. Total war. Once an AI has decided to declare war on somebody, it goes down a list to pick the best war target. This is where diplomacy comes into play.
This is a complicated thing. I've described it here and there over my Let's Play history, but this stuff here is not inaccurate. It's just a lot to cover on the show with the unit probs and how they're picking targets based on whether they're land targets or not, number of tiles bordering. It's a lot.
But we're all pretty familiar with dogpile.
Well, sure. Yeah, and some AIs that are actually relatively peaceful otherwise are more likely to jump into dogpile wars just because of their probabilities. The dogpile factor does matter in power, too. And here, too, it's pretty complex. Like, when a third civ is considering declaring on both you and your war target, it considers the opponent's power as part of its own when making that calculation. So, it'll add its power plus your power to determine if it wants to declare on the other AI, or its power plus the AI's power if it wants to declare war on you. And this gets even more annoying and complicated with more wars. But, when push comes to shove, most of them have such a power threshold that they have more than enough power to jump in, which is why you do get some dog piles here and there.
My power plus everybody else's attacking you's power. Yeah, let's just jump in.
Yeah, even if they don't plan a normal dogpile war, they might just get bribed in. You can usually tell the difference, because if they get bribed in, they often don't actually bring anything into your territory quickly. Whereas if they're planning the war, they'll send units pretty much the turn they declare.
Number 10. Flavors describe what kind of technologies a civilization pursues, whose numbers have been converted into words in this guide to low, medium, and high. There are many factors that determine what technology a civ will pursue, such as a random variable, a free technology, or a free great person, massive influence, the strategy the AI is pursuing, planning a war, etc. Since flavors only influence what technologies are researched to a limited degree, the usefulness of this information isn't as great as it could be. Number 11, factions. Peace weight is how the AI tends to divide themselves up. Low peace weights tends to be warmongers, but not always. High peace weights tend to be pacifists, and the ones in the middle fall in between. The greater the difference in peace weights, the more the AIs hate each other. And the more they hate each other, the more they declare war on each other. For our guide, and then that's the Civ Illustrated guide I'm quoting from here, we've divided up the peace weights into bad, neutral, and good.
It's worth noting for this particular thing that there's also a variance game to game in peace weight. I forget by how much, if it goes up to 2 or up to 4 or whatever, but you will see from game to game, sometimes like Gandhi and one of the more neutral people really hate each other because Gandhi rolled a higher peace weight than average for him and the other one rolled a lower peace weight than average. So, it's a guide, but you can't rely on it at 100% just because you don't know what kind of random numbers the game will throw in to alter their base piece weight. But, someone at the very far ends of the spectrum, like, say, Montezuma and Gandhi, Yeah, okay. Yeah, even if they both roll pretty well their maximums, they're still going to hit each other most of the time or almost all the time right from go.
Number 12, base attitude is how an AI starts off viewing everybody else. This is important to the player because it determines how fast you can get to pleased and friendly. The attitude an AI secretly starts out towards you with is very important. Number 13, possible diplomatic modifiers are all the civ-specific ways that you can build or hurt your relations with another AI. Our values are all thoroughly tested and correct. And again, our values, referring to the Civ Illustrated team, the values are the same regardless of game speed. All of the information was researched manually as it was not available anywhere else on these forums.
I actually can't verify these personally. Some of them I didn't know for sure. They look right to me, though, because I've played a lot. But you know, if they're saying they've tested them, then they probably are accurate, or almost definitely are accurate. And a lot of them do look exactly like what I remember them being, or right around where I remember them being. So this stuff is probably, it's good in that it's a unique source of this information. And I would check it out if you're still playing a lot of Civ 4.
Number 14, attitude thresholds are the diplomatic relations you must reach with an AI before they will perform a certain action. When an AI is annoyed at you, then you are potentially their worst enemy unless they hate somebody else more.
Yeah, but that's always the way. I hate you unless I hate somebody else more.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Or just a bigger enemy.
Number 15, favorite tile improvement is exactly what it says it is. An AI given a choice will tend to build more of that type of improvement. And lastly, 16, war behavior annoyance factor. Analysis and strategy is a written assessment of each AI written by a member of Civ Illustrated. It is not standardized like parts 1 to 15, so enjoy the freewheeling writing styles of each.
Oh boy.
My favorite of that, by the way, is annoyance factor.
Yeah.
This week on annoyance factor.
And I think that was going to depend on the player. For example, I really, really hate the AIs who piece facile all the time. And I also really hate the super expanding early AIs when they start out next to people who don't. So someone like Justinian or, hell, who else? The Portuguese, sometimes Victoria. You know, that gets really annoying when someone else decides, oh, I only want to build 3 cities while my neighbor builds 12 cities in the same time frame. That can get really bad, and it tends to break maps. So that's what annoys me, but other people might be more annoyed by Montezuma or Shaka because they tend to declare war on you. So it just depends.
Now, it's worth, I think, also noting here, and they document this as well in the thread, items that didn't make it into the guide, and they do provide explanations as to why they didn't include it, and of course it's up to you whether you agree or disagree, and to, well, what varying degree. City raising. All cities that have never grown to size 2 will auto-raise unless no city raising is turned on before the game starts. Well, that seems pretty straightforward. Favorite units. It is determined that this just wasn't a strong enough item in Civilization IV Beyond the Sword to matter.
I agree.
Missionary spam. No coding seemed to influence the behavior. Unit aggressiveness is important but didn't really affect how the human played in tests.
What? I think he meant the AI there, because it really didn't affect the human very much. How the human played in tests? That's not true. I mean, okay, it's a little bit esoteric, but it matters a lot. Like, the people who went always to war would specifically put in AIs with higher aggressiveness so that they would actually attack them, as opposed to just sitting huge stacks at their borders doing nothing but preventing them from ever improving their tiles. So that matters. Yeah, like he's saying, stealing workers and whatnot. If you go for a worker steal, and that's pretty common in high levels. I mean, just watch Absolute Zero in Deity. He'll try to steal workers quite frequently. And the more aggressive AIs are more likely to attack your warrior with that archer. I've seen in extreme cases in a very aggressive AI roll to decide to just attack with one of its 2 archers in its capital and kill your warrior, whereas somebody like Gandhi would never do that. So it can matter, and it can make a big difference, actually. It's something that you do want to consider, especially also when it comes to attacking your cities, because if you have somebody who declares on you, they'll tend to bunch up units while sieging your city. But if they're more aggressive, they're more likely to attack that city and lose all their units sooner than if they're not as aggressive. If they're less aggressive, then they might bunch up an overwhelming number of units before they're willing to do anything, and that can screw you. It can actually be harder to defend against somebody who's less aggressive because of that. Now, how important is it? I don't know. But it does actually affect your planning, in my opinion.
War declarations for refused demands. There was no noticeable effect. And I must admit, I read that, and I raised my eyebrow, and cue Star Trek's Mr. Spock, highly illogical, Captain. Did I miss something?
Well, yeah, 10 turns later, I think that was a botched test. Because the AI, if it starts plotting war, will not necessarily hit you in 10 turns. So, you know, that's probably not true. By the same token, though, how much is someone who's average versus that's likely to declare on you when you refuse a demand? How different is that? Usually when you refuse a demand, you can't defend yourself. They're going to come for you, unless it's one of the very, very peaceful AIs.
Turns before an AI will talk peace wasn't deemed important enough to include.
Really?
That's not important?
It isn't. And it sounds strange, but it actually isn't that important. The reason is if the AI is getting war success against you, i.e. you're getting your butt kicked, and it takes cities and whatnot, it's going to take a while before it's willing to talk no matter what. And on any difficulty that's challenging for you, if you lose a city or two or lose all your units, you're probably screwed. If you mess up to the point like that, you're probably not at a level where you're going to be capable of bringing the game back. And if you get a lot of war success, as in you kill most of their units, they're even more asinine AIs are going to want to talk because they just got war success all over. So it really doesn't matter that much. It matters a little bit. Okay, yeah, you might be able to bribe out of war against Chaka 5 turns later than against, say, Louis or something. But in practice, it doesn't matter that much.
Two more. Favorite religion, a minor factor, not important enough to include.
That's just what they pick when they found it. In-game, any AI's favorite religion is the religion they founded.
Yeah.
Unless you choose religions on and you see that someone founded Christianity, well, then you're like, okay, well, it's one of the civs that favor Christianity. You know, that's not very significant, especially since that's an optional setting. Otherwise, you know, Buddhism, oh, probably Izzy or, you know, Charlemagne or whatever. And just because Izzy likes Christianity doesn't mean she's going to switch to it. If she founded Buddhism, she won't.
And lastly, border tension sensitivity. However, the Civ Illustrated team notes that border tensions is currently under review.
Hmm.
So it sounds like they're reserving future judgment on that, but it is not included in the guide at present in their methodology. Now, the person, again, who started this thread was Catzilla. He was the leader for issue number one, he or she, the information section writer and researcher. The founder of Civ Illustrated, recruiter and analysis writer is Serial, that's S-E-R-A-I-E-L, and providing crucial links was Cossin, and I mentioned Cossin specifically because you can listen to him on episodes 86 and 87 from season 4 and episode 113 of season 5 of, yes, you guessed it, Poltergeist.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Polycast has been successfully nominated in the Best Produced category of the 2012 Podcast Awards. I think that's something that we can be proud of. Before November 15th, 2012, or even as of that date, you can vote every day, thanks to all who have and are continuing to do so.
Yes, I've already voted 3 times.
So if you're listening right now, go vote. It only takes 2 windows.
Your browser can handle that, right?
Yeah. 2 whole windows.
PodcastAwards.com.
This is Polycast episode 160. I'm Monica Lova, and I've been locked in here with these crazy people, including Dan.
Podcasting is already its own reward.
Especially Dan, you mean.
Yeah, seriously. Oh, and that was Monthar, who can say more if he wants.
No, he can't. He said it before you said his name. That's him.
And our other two loonies, Mad Jen.
Loony? Sweet. Can I get upgraded to a toonie?
And the Mian team.
Sanity is overrated anyway.
No.
Imagine.
What?
Mackie.
What?
Thanks for the blooper.
Thanks for the blooper?
It doesn't count if two different people say it.
Record date November 3rd, 2012. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.